right where Lonnie Swartz took his gun, the border agent, and shot through the slats and killed Jose Antonio Elena Rodriguez. Special thanks to our team on the ground in Arizona, Tamari Astudio, Trina Nadura, Maria Tadesena, John Hamilton, Libby Rainey, and Dennis Moynihan. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Go to our website for a full series, Death and Resistance on the U.S.-Mexico Border. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the evening news, but first, this from KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being a part of our amazing community. Please join us this year at Mike to the People, our annual election meeting. Do you want to help steer KBOO in a positive direction this fall? Plan on attending the annual election meeting, Mike to the People, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater and make your voice heard. Cast your vote by 1 p.m. at the event and enjoy refreshments and live entertainment with local musicians West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. Hear a report back from your board of directors and get to know this year's candidates. Record your fondest memories of KBOO in a minute or less at the Mic to the People booth. This is an all-ages and disability-affirmative event. Again, that's the annual election meeting, Mic to the People, Saturday, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, featuring West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. More information can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2019. Remember, your voice matters.
You're tuned in to community-supported KBOO Community Radio. Coming up next is the evening news. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, daily soup specials, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch, open daily until 5 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550.
Hear a report back from your board of directors.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, several states join Oregon in refusing Title X funding after restrictions made by the Trump administration.
A man in Lincoln County has been charged for beating a transgender woman using a woman's bathroom.
And in international news, lava is drifting towards Australia, bringing possible benefits.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 30th, 2019. I'm Desnaya Hawthorne.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund. In addition to Oregon, Illinois, Vermont, and Washington state health departments announced that they will no longer use Title X federal funding. This decision comes after the Trump administration recently mandated that any clinic receiving Title X funding could not refer patients for abortions. This new rule is also known as the gag rule. The gag rule affects many clinics still operating under Title X funding, even for states like Hawaii, which have announced but not yet fully withdrawn from the program. According to Planned Parenthood in Oregon, Oregon no longer receives Title X funding. Quote, Planned Parenthood health centers serve 41% of patients who get care through Title X funding, and nationwide Title X money prior to states' withdrawals funded 4,000 U.S. clinics, end quote. Services include STI testing, cancer screenings, and birth control, as well as reproductive wellness exams for both men and women. Title X is the only federal program dedicated to funding family planning. Clinics like Planned Parenthood note that the Trump administration's restrictions on Title X funding will most greatly impact women of color, LGBTQ people, and those living in rural areas.
Oregon's first museum dedicated to the cryptozoological phenomenon known as Bigfoot opened recently in Boring, Oregon. The North American Bigfoot Center is the brainchild of Animal Planet's Finding Bigfoot cast member and Clackamas County resident Cliff Barockman. Barockman is an avid Sasquatch researcher and has been scouring the wild of the world in search of the elusive beast for over 7 years. His goal for the museum is to inform the public of Bigfoot's pre-colonial history and significance in Native American culture, as well as provide an interactive community and retail space. He told Willamette Week the value of the museum is to show the depth and seriousness of the work done on this fantastically fun subject and open people's minds versus converting non-believers. Features of the museum include a simulated forest experience, indigenous masks, a compiled sighting database, casts of enormous footprints, and a 7'6" ape-like furry resident named Murphy.
Today in Newport, Oregon, Lincoln County courts charged a man with assault, harassment, and disorderly conduct following the beating of a transgender woman. Lauren Jackson, a homeless transgender woman, was using the women's bathroom at Agate Beach State Park when she was confronted by 37-year-old Fred Joseph Costanza outside the facility. Witnesses say that Costanza hit Jackson over 10 times in the face. Jackson suffered skull fractures and multiple breaks to her jaw. Due to the severity of the injuries, Jackson was promptly taken to OHSU in Portland. Costanza initially fled the scene but was later apprehended by police. Authorities note Costanza has a criminal record in other states and was intoxicated at the time of his arrest. Jackson gave her testimony to a Newport grand jury on Thursday. Costanza is being held on $140,000 bail and likely faces a hate crime charges as well. He'll be arraigned early next week.
Police responded to a southeast Portland residence Friday morning on a report of a shooting. Police found a woman pronounced dead due to a gunshot wound to the head, a man suffering from multiple gunshot wounds as well. The male was transported to a hospital with life-threatening injuries. Authorities arrived at the area of 174th Avenue and Southeast Powell at 3:33 a.m. A young child was also in the residence at the time of the shooting. The child is safe with no inflicted harm. No arrests have been made at this time in connection to the shooting, though officers are searching the area for suspects. The Portland Police Bureau Homicide Detail is assisting with the investigation and urges anyone with information regarding the shooting to contact police non-emergency phone number 503-823-3333.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes in northwest Montana held a conference this week on missing and murdered Indigenous people. The three-day event was aimed at raising awareness about the work being done to understand the scope of issues both on and off the reservation. Aaron Bolton has more.
This is the second conference the tribes have held this year since passing a resolution in January that created a local working group. Jamie Pluff is a member and an organizer of the MMIP conference.
And I think what we really want to focus on is what do we as a community do so that we're not just leaving this conference and saying, okay, see you at the next one,
Clough says some action is already being taken on the Flathead Reservation. Currently, Native Americans make up about a third of the 175 people in the state's missing persons database. However, that number is thought to be higher, something Clough says is a result of racial misidentification.
The data just really needs to be researched more to say, no, these are how many Native women are missing.
State Deputy Attorney General Melissa Schlichting sits on the Montana Missing Indigenous Persons Task Force. She says the group is working to foster better communication between tribal, state, and federal partners in order to fully grasp the issue in the state.
That's one of the primary responsibilities of the task force, is to create a new network that will plug into our existing NCIC and Missing Persons Clearinghouse so that we are sure that we're capturing all of the missing persons in Montana.
Four state laws surrounding missing and murdered Indigenous people were passed this year, and the state task force is due to submit a report to the legislature in the fall of 2020 with its recommendations for additional legislation. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
The Council of the Cherokee Nation Thursday confirmed the appointment of Kim Teehee to serve as the Oklahoma tribe's congressional delegate. Teehee could be the first ever delegate. According to the tribe, a Cherokee delegate to the U.S. Congress is in two treaties between the United States and the tribe and is affirmed in a third treaty. Teehee has experience advocating for tribal issues on Capitol Hill, including holding a position in the Obama administration. She was nominated by new Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr., who's been in office for a little more than 2 weeks. The tribe and Teehee will work on obtaining her delegate seat in Congress. The Cherokee Phoenix reports the Choctaw and Delaware tribes also have similar delegate language in their treaties. The Mattaponi tribe in the state of Virginia this week signed a trust land agreement. The agreement expands the tribe's reservation by more than 100 acres, nearly doubling the size of the current reservation. The land opens up hunting, fishing, trapping, and opportunities for new housing development. The tribe's located on a 150-acre reservation in King William County. The Justice Department announced Thursday another expansion of the Tribal Access Program to address public safety in Indian Country. The program provides tribes access to data in national crime information databases. It also gives tribes the ability to take mugshots and submit information to federal agencies. The Justice Department is seeking to deploy the program to more than 300 tribal agencies by the end of the year. Tribes use the program to register sex offenders, issue orders of protection, run criminal histories, and many other bookings and record checks. The God's Lake First Nation in Manitoba, Canada, issued a state of emergency this week in response to suicides of four young people. The CBC reports the First Nation has also been hit with more than 20 attempts over the summer. Leaders are seeking help from the Canadian government, saying community members are also struggling with drug and alcohol abuse. A community meeting is scheduled for next week. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Legislative approval has been granted to a controversial bill authorizing parents to bring medical marijuana products to their children on California school campuses. The bill was brought forth by California State Senator Jerry Hill and now awaits final arbitration from Governor Gavin Newsom. The bill would allow parents to bring medical cannabis products onto school premises and administer them to students who rely on them due to severe medical disabilities. Only non-smoking and non-vaping forms of cannabis are allowed, including oils, pills, and creams. The measure applies to students K through 12. Governor Hill's aim is to provide students living with certain disabilities to receive their medication without causing disruption to their education. Opponents to the bill argue student safety could be jeopardized by allowing drugs on campuses. Law enforcement officials say their priority is to prevent any youth under the age of 21 from accessing marijuana products. Former Governor Jerry Brown vetoed a similar bill last year, saying it went too far and maintained concerns about the purported medical benefits of cannabis. Similar laws have been adopted in other states such as Washington, Colorado, Florida, and New Jersey.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. And then at 7, it's The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight's weather is partly cloudy with a low of 61 degrees and a 10% chance of rain. Tomorrow's weather is mostly sunny with a low of 64 degrees and a high of 83 and a 10% chance of rain during the day. Today in history, in 1967, the Senate confirmed Thurgood Marshall as the first African-American justice to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. Justice Marshall was chief counsel of the NAACP during the 1940s and 1950s and used his legal background to help end segregation in the United States. The quote of the day is from Justice Thurgood Marshall. Quote, "A child born to a black mother in a state like Mississippi has exactly the same rights as a white baby born to the wealthiest person in the United States. It's not true, but I challenge anyone to say it's not a goal worth working for."
For the second time in a month, Ford is recalling automobiles due to safety issues. Potentially faulty seatback reclining mechanisms are the primary issue. Over 550,000 vehicles have been recalled. Concern lies in the ability for the seats to properly keep a person in place in the event of a crash. Earlier this month, smaller recalls were made on models missing manual park release covers. The previous recall affected 14,000 SUVs. Ford has not reported any injuries from the issues and expects most vehicles will not need repair. For this recall, Ford's reference number is 19C07. Repeat that. Reference number is 19C07. Contact your automobile dealer for more information.
Recent reports show that migrant girls in detention centers in the United States are receiving inadequate menstruation products. This insufficiency is so dire that migrant girls report that they are visibly bleeding through their clothes. These reports come from recent court filings in a lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security. Frequent mistreatment of migrant children poses additional serious concerns as the Trump administration attempts to dismantle the Flores Agreement. The agreement provides standards of care for migrant children who are in care with the United States, and it prevents migrant children from being held for more than 20 days. The lawsuit against Department of Homeland Security has been filed by 19 states. California's Governor Gavin Newsom, who is spearheading the lawsuit, said, quote, "Yet again, President Trump is disregarding basic human rights and using helpless migrant children as political pawns to further his ideological agenda. California will emphatically assert itself to protect the welfare and safety of all children, regardless of where they come from or the color of their skin."
A Veterans Affairs pathologist in Arkansas has been charged with manslaughter after the fatal misdiagnosis of three veterans. Robert Morris Levy has been found responsible for over 3,000 errors and misdiagnoses since 2005. It has been confirmed he was often under the influence while on duty. While some veterans were treated for disease they did not have, others were left with misdiagnosed cancers and other serious ailments. Levy has already been suspended twice for arriving to work while under the influence. He has evaded previous drug tests by using a drug that is not detectable on normal tests. It is alleged that Mr. Levy intentionally misdiagnosed the three veterans who died as a result. In two of the cases, he reported a false second opinion to support his own. Veteran Affairs Secretary Robert Wilkie said in a statement to Washington Post, quote, "The VA grieves for all the veterans and loved ones affected by this heartbreaking situation. It's hard to fathom how a physician sworn to do no harm could be so reckless." Levy has been chief of pathology and laboratory medical services at the Veterans Healthcare Systems of the Ozarks. His error rate of 8.9% is 12 times the normal error rate for doctors. Levy has pleaded not guilty to the charges, which include mail fraud, wire fraud, and involuntary manslaughter.
A massive raft of volcanic rock is drifting towards Australia. The rock mass was detected mid-August by NASA's Terra satellite and shows a pumice concretion roughly the size of Manhattan. The material is believed to have come from the eruption of underwater volcano near the island nation of Tongo earlier in August. Scientists say that this is a good thing. Various marine plant and animal life will populate the light porous rock, and their arrival and distribution down under could help revive damaged portions of the Great Barrier Reef. The reef is damaged because of years of pollution and from rising acidic levels due to CO2 buildup on the floor of the Earth's ocean. Estimates say the raft would reach Australia's east coast within a year. Scientists say that other pumice rafts recorded have been shown to have amazingly diverse ecosystems with great replenishing properties. The only drawback appears to be the strong sulfur odor that emanates from the huge mass.
A long-delayed trial for the men accused of 9/11 attacks will finally take place on January 11, 2021, in Guantanamo Bay. The alleged leader of the September 11th attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, is one of the five men that will face trial. Mohammed has been connected to violent crimes prior to the attacks. He was involved in the 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, and the attack on the U.S. warship, the Cole, in 2000. If convicted, Mohammed will likely receive the death penalty.
There was an earthquake yesterday off the coast of Oregon. KBOO's Althea Billings spoke to some experts about the quake and what people can do to be prepared for disasters.
Yesterday morning was a shaky one for some Oregonians as another earthquake struck off the coast of southern Oregon. The magnitude 6.3 earthquake occurred at 8:08 a.m. on Thursday morning, 184 miles northwest of Bandon, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. This is the second earthquake in that area this month. Is there any significance to this? Bob Houston, the interim legislative coordinator for the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, says not really. Over email, he said that seismic activity in that area happens frequently. The earthquakes have been located at the Blanco Fracture Zone, which is a transform boundary. The Blanco Fracture Zone is just one plate boundary in the region. Most notable for Pacific Northwest residents is our situation on the Cascadia Subduction Zone, where two tectonic plates meet. The Juan de Fuca plate, which lies off the coast of Washington and Oregon, is sliding under or subducting under the North American plate. It is not a smooth glide between the massive pieces of crust, so the pressure between them can build up, and when there is enough pressure, the pieces will slide past each other again, releasing the built-up energy in the form of an earthquake. Is there a connection between the recent quakes and the quote-unquote big one that is sometime in our future? Houston said, quote, smaller quakes off the coast are not necessarily indicative that a larger quake is imminent, but it is something to be tracked. Within the next 50 years, there is a 15 to 18% chance of a full margin Cascadia subduction rupture along the Oregon coast. So, sometime in the future, the area will face a large-scale earthquake. Alice Bush, Operations Division Chief at Multnomah County Emergency Management, says the county has plans in place.
Well, I would say that every government agency that I've interacted with in my 5 years with Multnomah County has response plans related to earthquakes. And there's a lot of community organizations, non-governmental organizations, private industry, and faith communities that also have plans in place to respond to an earthquake. I think, you know, the fact that we have response plans is one thing, and I think all of us have a lot of competing priorities, and there never seems to be enough time or personnel to accomplish all those priorities. And so I think with that being said, with the resources we do have, we're really focused on working to connect our diverse service providers across all sectors, government, private industry, nonprofits, faith communities. And what we are hoping is that when we're able to coordinate our efforts, we're going to be able to reduce the duplication and make those limited resources kind of spread a little further. There is incredible power in having a broad diversity of perspectives. And what we're hoping to get is those voices at every stage of our disaster preparedness. That includes planning processes, response, and throughout recovery. Mainly because we need that kind of broad base of diverse wisdom incorporated so that we can make sure that we provide assistance equitably. As far as the two sides of the rivers go, the ground around waterways is susceptible to something called liquefaction. And depending on the degree of saturation, the groundwater moves into the ground, and the ground in that area may lose its ability to support weight. So there's not a real difference of impacts between the east side and the west side. That liquefaction area is on both sides of the river. And that liquefaction can cause pretty significant damage to the built environment. And the Oregon Department of Geology has an online mapping tool called HazView. That's H-A-Z-V-U. And that tool allows people to type in an address and turn on the layers of the map to see where the liquefaction areas exist. There's also a layer that they can look at shaking.
The county has emergency plans in place, but in the event of a large earthquake, the river and the need to cross it will be a challenge.
There's going to be debris in the river, and when pieces of the bridges, the sloughing of the sides of the river, so there's going to be a lot of stuff in the river, and there's already a significant current in our river, and with material in the river, significant current, I would like to discourage people from trying to cross the river in the water, but I don't really think that I need to do that. The river's going to be pretty scary.
Not only will the river itself be hazardous, many bridges will also be out of commission.
Unfortunately, most of our bridges were built before our understanding of risk, of Oregon's risks from earthquakes. In fact, most of our bridges were built before we understood tectonic plates, at a time when more horse-drawn carriages were using the roads than cars. So they were not designed to withstand the impact of an earthquake. In fact, immediately after any earthquake, all of our bridges are going to require inspection to make sure they're safe for people to use. And right now, the only bridge that is considered as potentially viable immediately after the earthquake is the Sellwood Bridge. However, Multnomah County has identified the Burnside Bridge as a lifeline, and there's a website called Earthquake Ready Burnside Bridge, and it outlines our efforts to ensure that that the Burnside Bridge will be structurally capable to withstand a subduction zone earthquake.
The Burnside Bridge represents a lifeline, Bush explains.
A lifeline is more than just a bridge. So it's one thing we need to get a river, right? We need to get life safety equipment and personnel, people that can help do search and rescue and fire suppression and things like that. But getting across the bridge is only part of it. You have to get materials from across counties, right, to the bridge. So a lifeline is an area that we feel we are able to ensure accessibility from Washington County through Multnomah into Clackamas, that and Hood River across, if that makes sense. So it's and it was chosen as a lifeline because there's no overhead hazards. A lot of the other bridges have state bridges that are on top of it that are not expected to be usable after the earthquake and may have debris on the bridge.
What can people do to prepare? Bush says it's not just about making a disaster preparedness kit.
I'd say there's three main things that people could do. One would be talk to your family and your loved ones about what you plan to do after a disaster. And then think about what you might need to accomplish those plans, right? Whether that's learning a new skill or gathering some sort of supply. The most important thing, the best thing people can do to prepare for a disaster, though, is to create diverse friendships. These community connections create something called social capital. And in all of the research that I've read, it's these connections that help facilitate and speed recovery. And certainly, if people are able to store water or have a plan for how to treat water to make it safe for drinking or put together a kit of some essential items, that's also helpful. And there's a lot of websites that list items that people could include in the kits. Like the state of Oregon has a campaign called 2 Weeks Ready, and the federal government has a website called ready.gov. But I think it's incredibly important, having limited financial resources does not preclude somebody from becoming disaster resilient. Getting to know your neighbors, organizing a block party, making connections across all of our communities, work, faith, recreation, home, it's the most effective way to prepare for a disaster. In fact, talking about your disaster plans with others, especially if you've created diverse friendships, can help you discover each other's strengths as well as know how you can help each other. I'd say, you know, unfortunately, emergencies and disasters are part of our human experience and they are going to happen. However, their impact can be lessened through our relationships with our neighbors, our coworkers, and our friends. It's as simple as that. Making community connections is the most effective way to become disaster resilient.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Althea Billings.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 30th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jerry Wade and Annie Mayer. The producer is Claire Rashado, and our engineer is Claire Rashado as well. The KBOO Evening News director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to the KBOO Evening. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jezaniah Hawthorne.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. Stay tuned for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, an article in the New Republic about this month's historic Native American presidential forum ends by citing O.J. Siemens from the organizing group Four Directions, who says the event was ultimately less about the candidates than about the 5 million Native Americans across the country and the possibility of their seeing government as representing rather than oppressing them. We'll talk about electoral issues in indigenous communities with Mark Trahant, moderator of that presidential forum and editor of Indian Country Today. Also on the show, the saying that journalism